Hi, you're listening to Manufactured, a podcast about sustainability and the making of fashion. I'm your host, Kim van der Weert, a student of human rights, turned garment factory manager, turned sustainable fashion critic. On this show, I talk to some of the most integral people who manufacture what we wear. They aren't the people you see in fashion magazines, they're the people behind closed doors working in fashion supply chains. On the one hand, people often talk about legislation and regulation as if it's the golden ticket out of fashion sustainability problems. The logic goes something like this. The reason, quote-unquote, bad stuff happens in fashion supply chains is because of weak governance, quote-unquote, over there. Therefore, we must hold brands and retailers in the global north legally accountable for their impacts, including throughout their supply chains, primarily in the global south. In other words, those global brands and retailers are filling governance gaps, again, quote-unquote, over there. On the other hand, there's the curious case of apparel production in Leicester. Despite being in the heart of the UK, a quote-unquote developed country and leading superpower that's decidedly not, again, quote-unquote, over there, labor rights abuses in Leicester's garment sector have long been described as an open secret. This mini-series is dedicated to exploring this paradox. How is it possible that, despite strong governance and regulation, labor rights abuses have persisted in Leicester? What are the lessons and implications for our efforts to leverage legislation as a tool to fix fashion's sustainability woes globally? Each episode is a conversation with a different stakeholder group. We talk to a lawyer working on human rights abuses in Leicester, the leader of a local manufacturing association, a policy expert and government official, and a former production worker who, in recent years, has begun working in community engagement. This series has been co-created with Dr. Divya Jyoti, who some of you may remember meeting on the show before. Divya, a sustainability professional in a past life, is now a lecturer in the Department of Organization, Work and Technology at Lancaster University in the UK. She researches issues of ethics and sustainability in fashion supply chains while continuing her work with reform-oriented organizations. This mini-series has been supported by Lancaster University Management School and the Pentland Center for Sustainability in Business at Lancaster University, working in partnership with Justice in Fashion CIC, a UK-based not-for-profit that works to address imbalances of power and resources across the fashion industry supply chain. Last thing, we want this series to generate discussion and to be a two-way conversation. Share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. We're also going to be doing a live virtual conversation on 3 October to debrief and compare notes on these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Register via the link also in the episode description. In this episode, my co-host Dr. Divya Jyoti and I are in conversation with Councillor Adam Clark and Dr. Martin Quinn. Adam is a city councillor and former deputy mayor of Leicester City Council, while Martin is a reader and political economist working on regional development and the development of public policy at Lancaster University. Martin's research and PhD is focused on the regional development agencies in the East Midlands, where Leicester is located. Textiles have been at the core of the labour market in Leicester for more than a century, and the challenges the sector poses for the city's local economy led Martin to his work on the sector. We begin by discussing how Leicester, a city that's seen as a shining example of best practices when it comes to governance, can have such a long track record of human rights violations. We also try and uncover possible solutions, like the importance of providing business support to manufacturers and a garment trade adjudicator to regulate the relationship between buyer and supplier, and also stronger government support to address industry-wide issues. Finally, I want to flag that this episode was recorded before the recent election, and the government that Adam and Martin are referring to in this episode has since changed. Maybe we could start both Martin and Adam by having you briefly describe your connection to and your involvement with Leicester and the city's apparel sector, because I know your entry points are related, but quite different. Adam, let's start with you, and then I'll turn to you, Martin.
Yeah, sure. I suppose I describe myself as as somebody incredibly knowledgeable about Leicester, having lived here most of my life, but I'm by no means an expert in the apparel sector. I was brought up in Leicester, obviously very aware of Leicester's rich textile and garment manufacturing heritage, and actually quite passionate about it. And also very aware of some of the issues and some of the narrative around kind of post-industrialization issues within the sector. And politically, I've obviously been very engaged and involved in trying to support a thriving economy in the city for all the benefits that that brings to workers and to the reputation of a city that I love. But in terms of my kind of direct involvement within the apparel sector, it came about during the pandemic and as a direct result of the Sunday Times article that talked about there being up to 10,000 slaves working in Leicester's garment manufacturing industry. Now, this came at a time when Leicester was heading towards the first local lockdown during COVID-19. And as a deputy mayor in the city, I turned to the city mayor and said, you're having to talk to, you know, Boris Johnson, Matt Hancock and others within government, whilst we've also got this, you know, media storm around our garment manufacturing sector. And I basically said to the mayor, do you want me to take on that bit? I'm interested. I'm here and I can support you in this area of work. And that really set off an immersion, a personal immersion into the sector, and developed an understanding of Leicester's role within the UK garment manufacturing sector, but also an understanding of the supply chain and the compliant manufacturers within the city as well. And I got to know some of the big players in ASOS and Boohoo, and, you know, to broaden that understanding and also talk to parliamentarians and other decision makers nationally, which really for me has been a genuine privilege, actually, as well as kind of getting to understand some ingrained problems within an important part of Leicester's economy, but an important part of our national economy. It's also given me an awareness of the ability of others to seek to use what our weaknesses is in the economy and in the UK manufacturing economy and exploit those weaknesses for their own gains. And that's been incredibly challenging and I think incredibly damaging to a city that is actually one that has a really strong track record and a strong heritage and a real desire to be a fantastic garment manufacturing city going forward.
Thank you, Adam. And how about you, Martin?
Well, I moved to Leicester in 1996. To study, and then I ended up working at the university, and I ended up living in the city for over 26 years. So it very much became home to me. And as part of my initial work at the university, I was involved on a couple of research projects. One to look at, so this was around 1999, 2000, to look at the extent of the decline of the textiles industry from its kind of peak in the 30s, 40s, 50s through to what had happened kind of from the early 80s onwards, really, looking at the extent, you know, the sheer number of jobs that had disappeared in the boot and shoe industry and the big old textiles sectors in the city centre and those big mills that now form part of the cultural quarter. I then did a PhD on the regional development agencies and focused on the East Midlands and the work of the East Midlands Development Agency.
Can you just explain in a sentence what a regional development agency is?
It was, yes.
Was, indeed, you're right,
indeed,
you're right.
Was.
You told me that in our last chat.
So the regional development agency, there were one for each of the 9 English regions. They were set up by the Labour government of Tony Blair via an act in 1998 and were charged with developing the economic strategy for their regions. Now, the East Midlands one was one of the smaller ones because the East Midlands is one of the smaller regions in terms of population. The East Midlands faced a fairly unique challenge in that employment was always pretty high, but that employment tended to be in lower wage, lower skill economies. So they faced this challenge of how do we try and shift the economy along? Because you've got a lot of businesses that are doing all right, thank you very much. There wasn't like the urge that you've got, say, in the Northeast, where there was mass unemployment. It's fair to say that although the development agency did a lot of very good work. It also faced challenges, some of which were of its own making, frankly, in the way that it dealt with the region and the way that it became seen to be too closely associated with one of the three cities, too closely associated with Nottingham, frankly. Now, perversely, and this then leads on to my next area of interest for me, that focus on Nottingham actually helped Leicester in a very strange way, because what you ended up with in Leicester was a really strong reaction to that. So when the RDAs were got rid of by the coalition governments who came in 2010, Leicestershire was one of the first places to get going with its local enterprise partnership. Now, you could call me cynical for this, but I think a lot of that came as a kind of reaction to think to what happened with the RDA and the government office going into Nottingham. Leicester was in a position to show it was ready. Leicester was in a position to actually take advantage of the new structures and did so very well, in my opinion. So my research has kind of followed the development of that and followed what we do with city place development outside of the capital. And part of that work then led me to work with Bayes on the evidence base for the Levelling Up report. So I did a secondment to Bayes where we worked with Andy Haldane and others on the evidence that went into the Levelling Up report. And I've always been interested as a result in aspects of governance, aspects of leadership. So I think the example of setting up a city mayor role in Leicester is really interesting. And there's lessons for other cities there to be drawn on, in my opinion, and how that engagement's taken place.
Just to prompt, your current involvement with the sector.
Yeah, so I then moved. I moved to Lancaster. On my first day at Lancaster, I met Divya. So having left Leicester, my first conversation, academic conversation at Lancaster, was about Leicester. We started to talk about, well, how do we try and explain or investigate the fact that on the one hand, you've got what I think is an example of a very good governance system and an example of a city that has really taken the challenge of economic development and regeneration head on. And there's some really good examples that I think we might talk about as we go through. And yet we have this challenge of the textile sector just over the road, basically, and that kind of hidden part of the textile sector. And I think the challenge of what to do with the textile sector was always involved in the various conversations I was in. So I sat on the research advisory board for the LEP, and then its precursor, the sub-regional strategic partnership. And there was always this question of where do we include textiles in our economic development plans? Because it's been such an important, integral part of the growth of the city. What do we do with it? You know, how do we ensure that kind of, because as the city built up its cultural quarter, built up the heritage trails that you see around the city, which are fantastic examples of how to really sell a place and how to really kind of draw people in based on the different eras of the city. Textiles is huge in that. How do we make sure that that survives? So Divya and I's conversations at the beginning were, well, on the one hand, we've got this story of success, and on the other hand, we've got this enormous challenge in what's happening in a section of the textile sector.
Yeah.
How do we explore that? How do we try and explain that?
Adam, I see you nodding. Is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, it's really interesting, the position that Martin started from in terms of that. What I guess was an early attempt at not particularly accountable devolution in terms of the regional development agencies and then moving to local enterprise partnerships. Actually, the sector that made Leicester a city, the garment manufacturing sector, boot and shoe, made Leicester a city. Where does that sit within, as we go into the second quarter of the 21st century? For me, there is something about, and we'll probably come on to it later, this governance piece. And Leicester was the biggest city outside London to have a directly elected mayor in 2011, which was when I was first elected to Leicester City Council with Peter Soulsby, the current mayor, and the mayor then, in fact, the only city mayor the city's ever had. And we took on this new governance structure that enabled us to be fleet of foot as we were moving out of regional development agency, that enabled us to push forward on some of the great economic challenges that others weren't able to push forward on quite so quickly. But, and we'll probably come back to this later, but we still didn't have all the powers we would like to intervene in areas of the economy and actually other areas of city development. We still don't have the level of powers that people in North America and in Europe and other parts of the democratic world would just think were natural for us to have. But what we did have was an ability, an accountability and a mandate to work with others to try and to intervene at a pace where others might not be able to. And I think that has been an interesting part of the last decade.
Yeah, and I think that's why we were so keen to bring the two of you together, because as you know, as part of this series, we're looking at this sort of paradox or contradiction from a number of different perspectives. And you both, I think, albeit from very different entry points and through very different roles, have been thinking a lot about what are the sort of possibilities and limits that government can play in this picture. And I think that's what we're really interested in exploring with you today. Martin, you said something that I want to come back to just as a final piece of context. By most standards or by most metrics, Leicester is like a shining example of best practice when it comes to governance. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that? I mean, in what ways do we talk about governance and what makes Leicester to be considered such a role model in this department?
Yeah, sure thing. I just want to follow up on something that Adam says, because I think it is interesting the extent to which the UK is so different in regard of local place development and the powers that are given to local authorities and city leaders. The UK is the most centralised Western country. Nearly all the power still remains in the central national government. And, you know, I'm a member of the Regional Studies Association, an academic association. And when we go to conferences, those of us from the UK have a real job on our hands to explain, no, our city mayors can't do that. And it does place our cities and our towns in a particularly difficult position, I think, in comparison to their competitor cities across the rest of Europe, but also, as Adam said, North America. But the reason I mentioned, you know, in our previous conversations about Leicester, and one of the things I think that there's lots of lessons to draw from what's gone on in Leicester. One, quite simply, is the geography's right. You see a lot of interventions where the geography simply isn't right. Leicester as a city geographically has the advantage of being smack in the middle of its county, to the extent that it's almost like a donut or a fried egg. You've got this place in the middle and then everything around it is so obviously connected. So all the economies work together. That works really well. You look at Derby and Nottingham next door, they're both at the tip of their counties. You go to the north of those two counties and Manchester and Sheffield is having more of a draw. I think that explains to a degree why Leicester's been able to take advantage of that. You look at things like the Local Enterprise Partnership when it was put in place, it has much more genuine business representation on their boards and in the development of the ideas and in the discussions, partly because of that geography, because those businesses can see the reason to get involved. If the city does well, if the city grows, they benefit. Now, that wasn't necessarily the case with the RDA. If Nottingham does well, why does a business in Lincoln care? Why does a business in Northampton care? Leicester took advantage of that. I also think putting the position of elected mayor, for me, is critical here because it gives the city a focal point and it gives the city a voice. Now, there's a number of different things that I think are interesting with that. One has been, Adam's mentioned, he's one of the deputy mayors, that upon establishment of the electoral mayor position, once Sir Peter Salisbury was elected, a series of deputy mayors was put in place so that the mayoral position isn't just about one individual. It's about an office, and it's about an office that then represents the city. I think what you can see in Leicester, and you can compare it to the devo mayors, so Greater Manchester, Liverpool, Sheffield, South Yorkshire, isn't it? Cambridge, Peterborough, all the other mayoral elections, look at the turnouts. None of them scrape above 30%. I think the lowest turnout in a Leicester mayoral election has been around 35%. The highest was 59. And the year it was 59, it was actually a higher turnout than the wards for the general election that year. This is a mayoral position that actually attracts the involvement of the people, which is interesting. And I think, you know, there's a myriad of reasons for that. But I think this idea of representing the city and giving the city a voice is really important. The fact that it links so well to the Local Enterprise Partnership, the fact that you've got the businesses involved has been really interesting. And I also think the way in which the LEP and the Office of the Elected Mayor have hooked into success stories in the city very, very effectively. I think there's a real example here in terms of the One Leicester campaign that took place to promote the city, to kind of get this identity going of this is our city, let's be proud of it. And I know there was some sniping from the sidelines about the cost of the One Leicester banners, but it really got some traction. And I was doing a project at the time for the Regional Studies Association, looking at leadership and looking at how do you form contracts with different communities, different businesses, different people, you know, the kind of idea of a social contract at a subnational tier. Well, people hooked into that. People got into the idea that, yeah, this city's doing well. Within local government, within studies of local government, we don't really like to talk about PR, but actually I think there was a really impressive PR job done to kind of sell the place. And then things like the use of different badges to sell the different products. So the Leicester Creative Business Depot, Dock, the Space Park, where things that the council have done, things that the governance structure have done, where they haven't put their own badge up front, is a really important thing to do. I remember talking to some businesses in Leicester about the Regional Development Agency, and they weren't interested in anything that had East Midlands Development Agency at the front of it, because they've no credibility. Who are they? They're a bunch of local authority pen pushers. Why should I? What do they know about running a business? Which is a pretty daft approach in many ways from the individuals I was speaking to, but it's not an uncommon one. I think what the council have done very impressively is use different vehicles to get that credibility.
Would it be fair to sort of say then that when you say that Leicester is a shining example of best practice when it comes to governance, that in a nutshell, that is because they have done a very good job of actually engaging their respective communities and constituents, and that there is active involvement from those communities in government? Is that sort of in a sentence what you mean?
Yes, I think there are some really, really good examples of that engagement. I think there's some good examples of a system that's really done well in taking advantage of the geography, of the successes. And I think there's been some impressive efforts to engage. Clearly, as I think we're going to go on to, there's an element that engagement hasn't come through. Mm. But in plenty of it, and that's actually why it's a bit of a conundrum, in plenty of areas it has.
And that's kind of, in a way, the perfect segue, because on the one hand, Martin, what you've described is a situation where by most accounts, it seems like the sort of connection and the link or the bridge between constituents and government seems actually quite strong and well-functioning. And yet, you know, we've already talked about earlier on in this conversation, there is a poor human rights track record that's been highlighted by the media and described sometimes even as an open secret. And I think that's the paradox or contradiction that we're very much interested in exploring today. And Martin, I'd like to get your perspectives on this, but Adam, I'm curious to hear from you as well, and maybe I'll give you the chance to go first, because one of the things you said to us in an earlier conversation was that some of the most thoughtful, conscientious people built apparel businesses here, and they're really proud of those businesses, and they're really hurt by this reputation, and that you really take this sadness on board. And I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about that sentiment and your thoughts on what might be driving this disconnect between the apparel sector's reputation on the one hand, and then on the other hand, this picture that Martin has painted where it seems like Leicester is doing a lot of things right.
As I was talking before, during the pandemic, well, when it was safe to do so, I visited dozens of manufacturers and met at round table events and other sessions online and in person when we could. And what themes came through to me were around this real kind of strong bond and association with the sector, because a lot of the people I was talking to, they'd taken on the businesses from their parents. This was something that they felt deeply attached to and almost a moral obligation to continue. Many of these people were second generation. Their families had come over from Uganda after being thrown out by Idi Amin. They'd built a new life here. They contributed to the economy. Many of them had relations or acquaintances that had become ingrained in the civil society of the city, so had become councillors or contributed in some other way. They had a great sense of pride in the contribution that their business, their family's entrepreneurialism, had given to the city and helped to sustain a city through some quite dark periods, you know, the post-war period, the deindustrialization of the 70s and 80s, and the difficult period of COVID-19, and then to be hit with some of these really stark headlines, which that they felt was deeply, deeply unfair. It was something that I felt myself to be an unfairness, not only on them, but on a city that was undergoing some of the toughest reputational damage it had suffered in a very long time. You know, the first city to put into a local lockdown, and a city that was somehow harbouring slaves. I felt that was deeply unfair, deeply misrepresenting these good people that I was meeting and talking to, who themselves had a real sense of pride in the work that their families had done, but that they were doing as well. So they were looking at new technology, how to redefine fast fashion as not throwaway fashion, but something that was quick and efficient and in good working environments, and creating really kind of a positive intervention within a sector that was enabling 21st century technology to drive new efficiency and therefore new opportunities for a skilled workforce in a city that couldn't compete with places like Morocco or Turkey, but could find a way of doing things better and differently and more fairly and more equitably. But what they were being told was that you are complicit in an undermining of a sector to a degree where it is unethical and it is illegal and it is somehow a hotbed of modern day slavery, which frankly was not the case and has been borne out over time not to be the case. But that unfortunately has not been something that's gone back into the ether of the media.
And can I ask you, just before I turn back to you, Martin, what are your thoughts on this paradox? On the one hand, you have a certain narrative in the media. On the other hand, you have Leicester as a city seemingly doing quite well in terms of engaging. What are your thoughts on where does this gap come from and this disconnect between the people you know working in the sector and the way that you know the city government also works and the sector's reputation?
Yeah, it nearly joins up the first two parts of the conversation, really, doesn't it? I think there is this issue of governance. Well, Leicester has done really well with what it has had and what it has in terms of its powers and its ability as an influencer. But with the powers we don't have, there are huge issues in where those powers do lie. Now, Martin touched on the over-centralisation of the kind of Westminster system, where too many powers sit in Westminster. But what emanates out of Westminster is what somebody else described to me as an alphabetic spaghetti of enforcement and regulation, which actually leaves kind of local democratically accountable bodies, i.e. councils, out of the picture. So organisations like Revenue and Customs, Gang Masters and Labour Abuse Authority, the police, the Health and Safety Executive, and a smaller organisation called the ESA, they kind of have a lot of the powers to regulate the sector. And between them, they have very complex information sharing agreements, and the same with ourselves. And so what you end up with is, where there are issues, and nobody is saying there are not issues in the garment manufacturing sector in the UK, there is not the structures and systems to regulate, not only to have really good intelligence on what's happening within that sector, but where there are issues to then go and enforce on those issues. And I think that has created that space where there has been an opportunity for others to provide quite a lot of misinformation around actually the state of the garment manufacturing sector because of that over-centralised system. And what emanates out of that is a too complex a regime that doesn't really have the intelligence or the insight to look into it and to deal with it.
I just want to prod you a little further. It was very interesting, and you've spoke about this disconnect between the narrative and the media and the city doing well. But I think there is one more disconnect, which kind of, you know, is an imagery evoked in my mind, which is that in people's lived experiences, there are certain people within certain communities who do find things incredibly hard, and they have somehow been linked within the sector, right? They are either previous garment workers. Most of them have recently lost their jobs. Some of them have had families who have been in the sector. So one element that you've spoken about is the intelligence to do with the functioning of the industry and the regulating the business practices. But any thoughts or reflections on the people themselves from the governance perspective?
I have lots of thoughts. So I think, you know, workers in the UK have been kind of underrepresented over many years. And where you have a workforce that is predominantly from communities that have not originated or have not got a very long standing history in the country, they are de-educated by being here and their opportunities are not made open to them. So we talk about people being hard to reach in communities. Actually, they're seldom heard because they're not given the platform to access services and opportunities. And so kind of almost doors have been closed to people to access opportunities to learn English, to talk to people about their rights in the workplace, to upskill, to move on in a career in a sector that, you know, has a great potential to grow. And there's a great capacity of workforce of people that, you know, that want to develop their skills. And we've, you know, I've learned a bit about that along the way and tried to provide for that as much as we can along the way. Providing that platform for work to a workforce to have a voice is really important. The other side of that is about this narrative and where we've had jobs being lost in the sector and factories closing. There are economic reasons for that. There are kind of macroeconomic reasons for that, as well as reasons associated with the reputation that has been perpetuated by this narrative that has taken hold, not only by the fact that there are problems in the sector. And there are problems in the sector, and I don't want to get away from that fact. I don't want to say, you know, Leicester is a shining light throughout. There are issues within the sector. But actually, it's the narrative that has helped Boohoo to move away from the city and other retailers to move away from the city, you know, which has enabled factories to close. It's the narrative that has been a key determinant in some of those jobs being lost or jobs being reduced, in kind of the hours people being able to work being reduced, and therefore people being pushed to food bank and to benefits as well. And it's the narrative is something that we can all shift and we can all change. There are other things we can do, but I think trying to change that narrative, I think, has been part of my kind of personal mission.
Yeah, and I'm smiling because that narrative shift, I think, is, although an entirely different world, entirely different context, that narrative shift is why we created this podcast. Because for the same reasons that you've just described, that I, you know, my experience as a factory manager and a lot of my people that I know who work on the factory management side, that there's a need for sort of like a narrative shift, then that's not to say that stuff isn't happening, you know, that there aren't adverse impacts in the fashion industry, but there's a need for like a narrative shift around why that stuff is happening. Because I think a lot of times implicitly that burden sort of lands with, in the case of our show, with the manufacturers, which is, it's really kind of surreal to hear somebody sitting in Leicester describing kind of like a similar desire or ambition, at least for me, because that's not something I ever expected to have happen to me.
Yeah, I suppose if we're talking about this kind of academics on the call, if we're talking about a kind of a research question, I would ask the question, you know, is there a deliberate reason why people would not want to shift that narrative? So I'll give you an example. Operation Tacit was the government-led investigation that was launched during the pandemic after the Sunday Times report, which talked about up to 10,000 slaves working in Leicester's textile sector. A review of Operation Tacit, which completed well over a year ago, has yet to be published. And I know that it's been completed, and I know the authors in Labour Market Enforcement have completed and submitted it to government. But for some reason, it has yet to be published when we were told we would get it by the end of last year, by the end of 23. It's still not been published.
And this is like an investigation?
So Operation Tacit apparently conducted over 600 what they called victim identification visits to factories, over 600. Now, you would have thought that given the narrative that pervaded before that, that there would have been some enforcement actions, many, many cases of modern day slavery identified given the narrative. but that hasn't emerged yet. I'll say yet, but I doubt whether it will emerge.
You mean like the legal action, the enforcement hasn't emerged yet?
Yeah, so no enforcement. So no enforcement action has emanated that has been published in a review. No, doubtless issues were found and there have been cases investigated, but there's been no response to the success or otherwise of Operation Tacit, which was a big government investigation that involved all those agencies I've referred to. And Leicester City Council led on the community engagement element of that because we were already doing that work in the years leading up to that. And so a question would be, why has there been no report on that? Another one is that the government, in their last manifesto, said that they would set up a single enforcement agency to bring those agencies together to stop that alphabetti spaghetti of enforcement. That single enforcement agency has never been formed or founded. It doesn't exist. Mm. They've actually apparently dropped that manifesto pledge, which was something they were elected on to do within their manifesto, but they've been able to push it into the long grass and it not to happen. Why isn't it seen as a priority to sort out these problems that people on all sides of the political discourse agree is an issue, needs to be dealt with? And there are countless other examples of identifying the problem, coming up with a solution, that solution not being followed through. And while all this happens in the slow wheels of government, you've got manufacturers trying to suggest solutions themselves, trying to be transparent. You've got trade unions, you've got workers all trying to come up with solutions themselves, when there's a general understanding that actually the governance that underpins all of this is failed. And I don't say that from a party political point of view. There is a general understanding that there isn't the governments in place to deal with those, or at least to have a good oversight of what's happening within the sector, which comes back to your point. The reason for your surprise is it that there are reasons for these issues not to be dealt with, to maintain that power in Westminster, to have this alphabet spaghetti agencies out there struggling to share information, to take any action where it needs to be taken?
Hi. Sometimes I feel kind of like a madwoman sitting in my living room recording myself talk. If you want to help me with that feeling, share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on October 3rd to debrief and compare notes on these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Register via the link in the episode description. So, Martin, I want to give you a chance to talk on this, but I hear sort of broadly two things. We've got this paradox. On the one hand, Leicester seems to be doing very well on governance. On the other hand, we have the reputation of the garment sector and the apparel sector in Leicester. And Adam, from you, I hear sort of maybe two layers or two sort of prongs, I guess, to maybe where that is coming from. The first is the relationship between local government and national government, and whether the local government actually has the powers that it needs to actually sort of engage adequately with this sector. And I'm curious, Divya, after Martin, I'm going to come to you because I'm like curious to think and to extrapolate, like, on a global level, what does that mean? You know, is this just like a niche UK issue, or is this are there implications more globally? But then the second sort of strand of thought that I hear too is that although governance is sort of overall quite strong in Leicester, that it nonetheless is somehow uneven. There are certain communities or populations, particularly those that are working in the apparel sector in Leicester, that maybe struggle to have that engagement or to have that access or relationship with government, even with the local government, even if at a sort of macro level, the local government is doing a lot of things right. And that's related to the history and language barriers, historical barriers, whatever that might be. And so, Martin, I want to turn to you and say, okay, does that resonate with you? Is there anything you would want to add to the list or take off the list?
Yes, a lot of what's just been spoken about really resonates. And I think, as does happen in these kind of conversations, my mind's going in all sorts of different directions right now, around the kind of narrative idea and around some of the maybe contextual factors here. We mentioned earlier about that shift from the industry that built the city to going into its decline in the 80s and onwards. We're kind of dealing with, and we've dealt with, the idea of an economy in transition. And that's not unique to Leicester by any way. You know, the UK's been through a transition from an industrial-based economy into a service sector-based economy. We see economic development agencies, whether that's local authorities or things like the LEPs and the RDAs that preceded them, charged with economic strategies. But it's all focused around particular metrics, around higher wages, higher skills, tech, new. In any economy, of course, there's going to be people at the bottom, and they tend to get left out of those measures. So the very things that things like the LEP, things like the economic development strategies are measured against, don't really include the people who are working the minimum wage jobs, who are working those jobs at the bottom. So I think they get left out of some of those discussions. And I think when you have the system that we've had, and when you've been through 14 years now of austerity politics, and I'm not saying that again, I'm not saying that as a party political point, but that's what we've been through, basically. Of course, decisions have to be taken on where to focus your resources. Now, there was some discussion earlier about access to, say, English language skills, and one facet that has disappeared from a lot of local authority spend in the last decade and a half is library facilities. Now, particularly Leicestershire County Council, they had to lose a third of their budget, and part of that, they decided to move towards community-based libraries. It removes a lot of resource. It removes a lot of access to information. I think there's also something just around the kind of economy we have, and this is a more global point. But, you know, from the 80s onwards, we've had this kind of neoliberal creed, and that what we need to do is make sure, basically, we take decisions to make sure that our priority industries do well. There's an infamous quote from Thatcher, from Norman Tebbit, that unemployment is a price worth paying for low inflation. So basically, we're quite prepared for the coal industry, for the steel industry to die out in order to support our finance and our service sectors. I do think there's an element here of some basically saying, okay, we've got this bad news now about the textiles industry in a small part of the city of Leicester. We can intervene, or we can let it die out, and we can try and change the narrative and try and focus on the good stories. And some of the meetings I was involved in, I do think you saw part of that from people from sectors outside of textiles, to say, actually, the way to deal with this is to let it go rather than intervene, because intervening, of course, costs money, and intervening takes resources. And that wasn't the council saying that, I should emphasise. But, you know, there was an element of, well, rather than spend your resource on that, spend your resource on us. Spend your resource on these shiny new bits that tick your metrics, yeah? And so I think there's an element there as well. In terms of the kind of engagement with and the willingness of some communities to engage and the efforts that are being made, I think, you know, there is a consistent effort being made to connect with the different communities in Leicester. But going back to some early work I did where I spoke to a number of councillors in the city, and I'm sure Adam's going to realise maybe some of them. There were people who were represented, say, the Castle Ward in the city, which covers the city centre, and it covers Clarendon Park and Stoneygate, which, for people listening, what you've basically got there is the city centre bit, which is maybe some of the more deprived wards, up to Clarendon Park and Stoneygate, which are some of the more affluent wards. And those councillors were saying to me, it's much, much easier to fill the hall and talk about local issues in Clarendon Park and Stoneygate. People are just engaged. The more transient populations in the middle don't get involved. And that's one of the things that me and Divya have been trying to look at. And there's this concept that we've been playing around with and toying with that might explain some of this, is that people bring with them past experience of authority. And so, as Adam rightly said, you know, you've got big communities in Leicester that have experienced displacement twice in two or three generations, from India into Uganda, from Uganda into the UK. With that comes a lack of trust. So it's not necessarily a lack of trust in Sir Peter Soulsby. It's a lack of trust in authority. And therefore, you've got communities there that, why would I go and tell that authority that there's a problem with the wages in my factory? Because they might just shut it down. And that's not, as I said, that's not a comment on Leicester. It's a comment on lived experience. And so there's an enormous challenge there.
What I'll say from my side is that this disconnect that you're describing between the government and, let's say, manufacturers or maybe even people working within manufacturing. It's interesting because my assumption before beginning this series, like I see that at a global level as well. I see there's all this legislation coming in the European Union, wherever, that's like looking to hold brands and retailers that are headquartered in those jurisdictions accountable for what is happening in their supply chains. And when you look at that, some of that legislation, what is very clear is that this legislation has been made by people who really don't understand how global fashion supply chains work, down to like the terminology that's used to refer to different actors. And I know I've had conversations with some suppliers just trying to figure out, are they in scope? Are they not in scope? And it's really not straightforward. And I assumed that that was because of the geographical distance between where the legislation was being made and the people who were ultimately going to have to kind of do the heavy lifting to get those global brands and retailers compliant. And that was my assumption. But now when I listen to this conversation, for me, that's kind of an open question, because you're describing, in, I think, in many ways, something quite similar. But that industry and that government are in the same place, right? So as you said, there's something else going on there. And maybe that's a good segue, Divya, to turn to you to talk about, okay, well, what does implications do you see from this conversation for sort of this more global conversation about the role of legislation in sort of being our golden ticket out of all of the human rights and environmental abuses that happen in fashion supply chains?
I think you've set us up nicely, because what you've just said is that this is deterritorialized as an issue, as a challenge. We keep positing, let's have stronger and stronger laws captured in text. Somehow we get to an agreement, which is not easy. What's happening currently with the due diligence directive, just arriving at that agreement is a challenge. And then the assumption in some ways is, okay, you know, we will be able to, I would say, implement it. I think couple of things have emerged in this conversation. One is just the intricacies within the governance infrastructure when you think about implementation and enforcement. And the point that you're making is that it is not about a particular geography. I think it is about those relationships and those actors and those negotiations which are not sufficiently acknowledged.
Which relationships do you mean?
So there was a point about the workers or the people in the community not engaging, right? And their inclusion or not in this conversation. The manufacturers, the change in, you know, who is actually, because it has overall, over the years, changed the manufacturing community. The kind of businesses they are doing, some have wrapped up and moved on. Others have actually entered the industry as the industry's nature has changed. So going back, I think from the conversations about thinking about the global industry, I think it's a complex web of those relationships which need to be thought through when we are thinking about the different actors assuming responsibility for enacting or, you know, their behavior in a particular way within that context. And I think that perhaps needs more attention, rather than saying that, oh, you know, we kind of rely on the most powerful actor, and by doing so, we kind of make them even more powerful, if you know what I mean. We kind of, you know, strengthen their power by keep repeating, oh, but you are the one who should assume responsibility, and somehow you've got to take care of the problem, and not give the other actors the issue of voice that emerged of the other manufacturers, the what we've heard within the case of the UK, the local government actually not having a voice, which is why Leicester continues to intrigue me as a site, because my experience was very different. You know, much like you, I was working in India. Yes, there are some similarities, and I do want to, you know, point attention to it, because you spoke about transitional economies, you spoke about transient population. Again, that is by no means a UK-specific phenomena. That's a global phenomena. There's a, within countries, within Bangladesh, you see that, you know, people moving in to work within the garment industry, similarly in India and elsewhere. So it is, there are, I would say, global lessons to be learned, and I think there are questions which are being raised in this conversation. I don't think we have answers, but we definitely have like a long list of questions.
The other question I was going to ask was, and I know it does come back to governance and structure, but who audits the auditors is a reasonable question to ask as well. Because I think within supply chains, There are different audit regimes, a whole multitude of audit regimes, which don't sit within any kind of real, as I understand it, national, international framework of what good looks like from an auditing perspective. And they're looking at very different things in very different places. And for me, it's very basic, is that if you have a framework, it can be a flexible framework for people to work within, then you enable people to work effectively and fairly. And I just don't think nationally and internationally there is that effective framework. And I think from an international perspective, and if we talk about migration, people coming to, you know, people going to places to find work, if we think about the impact of climate change as a threat multiplier and that causing mass migration, maybe it's a good time to be looking at this stuff, you know, because we're not going to be seeing less migration as a result of climate change. We're going to be seeing more migration. And therefore, we probably do need to look at what safeguards we need to put in place to support new communities moving to different places. And also, we probably need to think about how we do make locally produced garments and locally produced everything else, how we create places to enable that to happen more because of a need to shorten supply chains geographically, potentially, and to enable places to be more self-sufficient over shorter distances.
I guess, like, for me, it's interesting because I'm not really in the world of Leicester, and I'm reflecting on, Divya, your comments on what is sort of the wider applicability of this conversation. And for me, like, what I keep coming back to is, like, if Leicester can't figure this out, who can? And what I mean by that is, like, in the picture that you guys have painted, Leicester has a lot of things going for it in terms of things that would hypothetically position it strongly to be able to do something, let's say, about how people are treated in the fashion industry. And what I mean by that is your city governance is, by all accounts, quite strong. Maybe there's some unevenness in terms of access and ability to, for all groups to engage, but, like, overall, check. You also are dealing with one geographic or physical location. The industry and the government are in the same place. So in theory, I mean, barring your sort of comments, Adam, about the relationship between local and national government, if I compare it to the rest of the fashion industry, there's sort of proximity, geographical proximity between the actors involved and the government, whether local or national. And we're dealing, and I don't know if this is the right word technically, so you guys can correct me, but we're dealing with sort of one jurisdiction. What I mean by that is we're talking, all of this is happening within one country. And when I think about, like, the sector globally, we're talking about the EU or the United States or whomever, the UK, passing legislation that is going to have implications for people in an entirely different country. And so I kind of, like, look at this conversation and I feel, to be honest, a little bit overwhelmed.
I just want to add one point in your analysis, and I think it's important we touch on that, because all of the factors that you've highlighted are about the local governance where we had the site of production. What is not controlled or is completely outside of the currently remit of this governance framework is the capital, is the brands, is those actors which are actually kind of, they do have a strong influence in shaping a lot of these behaviors and relationships. Maybe going back to your, you know, point about if these legislations are meant to control the behavior of the brands in their home countries, then what is that legislation actually trying to control? And maybe that's where one segue is, that there is a need for actually much more greater collaborative working. And this is another piece with which I've had some chats with Martin and a couple of others about, a place-based approach when you think about your supply chains. The case of Leicester is interesting because the company itself is registered in the UK. So if you would think about it, it should be possible. Yeah. I mean, so Boohoo next has the head office in Leicester. And I think that is one piece of the puzzle which perhaps we need to think more about. So I just wanted to add that to your point.
Do you mean, like, that actually maybe what we need to be looking at, or the sort of missing ingredient here, is something around what are we actually holding brands and retailers accountable for?
Yes, and how are those relationships being forged?
Which relationships?
The buyer and supplier relationship, which has the whole consequence of, you know, kind of getting people on board. I feel like...
Just because you mentioned that relationship specifically, there is definitely an imbalance, obviously. I think that's been borne out of conversations or media pieces or documentaries that we've seen between buyer and supplier, and where there are issues, if we come back to the relationship with the manufacturers, you know, where there are issues, there's an argument to say the manufacturers are only guilty of being squashed by the buyers, which is putting them into a position where they are quite wrongly acting unethically, but they are still being squashed into doing so. And there has been this, what I think is a good idea, a solid idea, of a garment trade adjudicator, which happens in other sectors, which helps to regulate that relationship between a buyer and supplier. And, personally, I think interventions like that are definitely worth looking at and developing.
Could you do that?
Of course we could do that. Like I say, it exists in other sectors. It's been proposed by other agencies. I've supported it. Leicester City Council supported it.
So what's blocking it?
Again, I ask the question, and it comes from the narrative piece that we discussed earlier. Who started the narrative? Who perpetuates the narrative? And your kind of question about, if Leicester can't do this, who can? I suppose, I then ask the question is, maybe Leicester is doing it really well as it can within the circumstances it's given, but the narrative is saying that it isn't. That's not the actuality of the situation. And I suppose we wouldn't be here having this conversation if you weren't reading things saying Leicester is picked out here. But who has picked Leicester out? And actually, I'd put to you that maybe the sector isn't better or worse than any other comparable sector, and maybe Leicester isn't better or worse than any other comparable city or geographical area. The fact is that we've been picked out by a narrative that has been perpetuated. So yes, there are issues. There are huge issues within post-industrial Britain. There are huge issues in terms of in-work poverty. That is known across sectors. There are people claiming benefits who are working, which is morally wrong, in my view. And there are issues around enforcement of things like national minimum wage. There are huge issues around that in the garment sector and beyond. There is a focus on Leicester, because it is a confined geographical area, I think, and because the garment manufacturing sector is so significant in Leicester, and therefore it's quite easy to see, and there are issues, but there may be other reasons why people want to pick out Leicester as that whipping boy, as I described it previously. And we wouldn't be having this conversation if that narrative hadn't been perpetuated, which is an irony, I think.
Right. But the alternate narrative is a lot harder to have. It's something around, I think, inequity, right? And inequity in these brand supplier relationships, inequity, also other types of inequity. And how do we use legislation to actually address inequity, as opposed to right now, it seems like we're using legislation to address a narrative that maybe isn't quite the right one. Martin, I want to ask you, is there anything you want to say that you haven't had a chance to say?
There's no doubt that across the economy in the UK, there are people working on minimum wage who need benefits to top up their employment, their wage, to be able to pay rent and to buy food. And we only seem to focus on one or two of those sectors. To the extent that, we even get government schemes put out where the narrative is, come work at a supermarket or a high street store in exchange for your benefits. Now, in a way, how's that any different to what we've seen in the textiles industry? But as has been talked about, the narrative of the two are presented very differently. I do think that one of the key things here is, we can rightly identify a lot of positive things about the governance structure in the city of Leicester and indeed in the broader county of Leicestershire. And we can look at positive examples of governance structures elsewhere. For me, place development and economic development has to be underpinned with the resource needed to not just look at the interventions that are going to make those headline interventions, like the number of tech startups, for example. And they don't have that. It's fairly easy for central government to make any city or place, elected mayor, LEP, to blame them for the problems within their local area. But if central government doesn't give them the resource they need to have a more holistic approach, to enforce the regulation, then they're fairly powerless in some of these things. These are big organisations. They're protected by the national framework and national regulation. But when there's a news story about what's gone on in the textile sector in Leicester, it's the local council.
You could swap out that story at a global level exactly this.
With, of course you could.
Swap out the names of the players and you have the same story.
Yeah, of course you could. But, you know, I think that's, but it's something we need to keep acknowledging.
Yeah.
There are undoubtedly things that can be done. And I think there's some interesting things that can be done. And there's also interesting things that are happening that can be learned elsewhere. And those narratives, I mean, it's a really interesting point about the narratives and exploring those narratives. But regulation of these sectors, I mean, part of the problem, of course, is the regulation is done by the industry itself.
By parts of the industry itself.
Part of the industry, okay, but the people who are making the money right at the top, yeah? And of course, how are they going to regulate it? You know, it's exactly the same after the financial crash. What happens? We let the banks decide how to regulate the finance sector. If there's issues in the textile sector, don't let the brands regulate it. You need agencies, and it comes back to what Adam was saying about all the different agencies that are acting. They're not joined up. And I know joined up government is a loaded term and associated with previous governments, but it's not a bad idea to actually allow the various agencies to work together and give them the strength and the power and the resource to work together.
Is there anything that you really want to say that you haven't had a chance to say?
Can I just add just one element of the conversation that we've not really focused on that we at Leicester City Council have been leading on, and that's around providing business support. So bringing in funding to support manufacturers to enable them to work more productively across the board, but also from a point of supporting their workforce, having good environmental credentials as well. So we've brought in pockets of money from various funding sources. The European Union, we used to have them, that was great. And a little bit from national government as well. And that support we've been able to provide has enabled us to continue our conversations. And I think, you know, it's really important that there's an ongoing support for accountable local authorities to engage with all sectors across the economy, but particularly those priority sectors, as this is in Leicester. And the other thing we've been able to do is to set up a textile training academy with an organisation called Fashion Enter. That is something that deserves greater investment, greater support, because it is not only providing skills training in workers' rights, sewing, English language, across the board, any, you know, skills that you need to get on in the sector. It's also, again, providing that opportunity for democratically accountable organisation like the City Council to interact with the workforce in the sector. And the other element is, we haven't talked about, is the third sector, is those charities, the Justice in Fashion, Slave Free Alliance. There's other campaigning organisations, Lay Behind the Label. There's other organisations. You know, how can we better support them? Because they have a stake in this. But also support them to work with us as well. Because what happens when you get these kind of, this focus on a place, is you get everybody wanting to help. And that's brilliant. There's nothing to enable that structurally to that happen in a coordinated way. We've tried to do that in Leicester, but with very limited resource. And I suppose that kind of that multi-agency, multifaceted partnership and structures for that is something that I think is required in a well-functioning civil society.
Divya, is there any final words from you?
I just actually want to pick up on this last point. This point about, you know, resources and these encouraging efforts and the need for actors to work together. I'm kind of connecting it to the local conversation in Leicester, so to speak, and the global. Often we are trying to find one actor to put
the bad guy,
pin the responsibility onto, right? Oh, you know, that's the government is not doing it, or the brands are not doing it.
Or the factories. You
know, or the factories are not doing it. And I think that is something which requires further deliberation and thinking, whether you're thinking of legislation as a way or even, you know, the self-regulatory approaches, which when you say the government should be doing it, but the government doesn't have the resources. The reason brands have to do it is because they have the wherewithal in terms of the resources. So I think that's a conversation which perhaps we need to think about as to how do we draw on resources and surely materialize, give a tangible shape and form to the kind of partnership that Adam's kind of alluded to at the very end, both I think at the local level as well as global level. Because, I mean, just speaking of Leicester, there are so many actors, so many people who are interested, who even I have met. And I keep saying and keep thinking, how do we connect all the dots? And this is just one geography where you know people. So when you think about a global scale, perhaps it's even more complicated. But maybe that's food for thought as to how do we actually talk about this collaboration and make it happen. Perhaps that's something worth thinking about.
Thank you for listening to Manufactured. I've been your host, Kim van der Weert, and if you learned something new from this episode and want to support the show, come say hi to me on LinkedIn. Also, share your musings, ramblings, or questions about this episode, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on the 3rd of October to debrief and compare notes about these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Links to the voice memo, community wall, and event registration page can be found in the episode description. And of course, subscribe, rate, and review us on the podcast app you're listening to this episode on.